Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to participate in this session. And I'm going to talk a little bit about treatment optimization and just how far we should go in providing algorithms to investigators for the utilization of remote telemonitoring information. Financial disclosures are shown on this slide. So let me just start off with an overview, comparing and contrasting treatment versus monitoring trials. Some of these points have already been raised during our discussion. Treatment trials generally study drugs or devices which provide treatments. Monitoring trials provide diagnostic information. Treatment trials are directly therapeutic, whereas monitoring trials are therapeutic only if the information is used. For treatment trials, effectiveness relies on patient adherence, such as taking a medication, or it may be automatic in the case of an implanted device, whereas in monitoring trials, effectiveness relies on clinician adherence. That is, the clinician must act on information received. And finally, treatment trials often include specific algorithms for treatment optimization. So I don't want you to think that the provision of such algorithms in monitoring trials is something new. In fact, treatment trials often include titration protocols. For example, studies of ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers or beta blockers included forced titration protocols. And in fact, a lot of sponsor support was provided to study sites in order to learn how to titrate these medications, with beta blockers being the classical example. It was easy to stop titration early in the course of those titration protocols without support and coaching from peers and from study sponsors. Similarly, these trials often include optimization protocols. This is the case for some device therapies, and perhaps the most classic example is for cardiac resynchronization therapy, where many of our CRT trials have included protocols for assessing the integrity of the LV lead and the capture for LV pacing, have included AV and VV optimization schemes, which in fact were provided for in the study protocol and often facilitated by the study sponsor. And I'm going to argue then, similarly, that in monitoring trials, we should in fact be including specific algorithms for treatment optimization. And I'm going to show you that in fact, when we don't do this, our studies fail. So putting diagnostic monitoring devices in the hands of clinicians without providing them with the additional tools or information, a system or strategy for care, will result in ongoing failure of randomized controlled telemonitoring trials in heart failure, whether those be non-invasive systems or implantable monitors, such as impedance monitors or implantable hemodynamic monitors. Next slide, please. So let's take a look, and you've already seen some of these examples, but let me first highlight some of the failures in monitoring trials to date. The first reviews some of what Dr. Anker presented, and while he highlighted the positivity of 10 HMS on all-cause mortality, it's important to note that when we look at combinations of mortality and morbidity, or heart failure and morbidity alone, that all of these trials have failed. The TELE-HF trial, which is the largest randomized controlled trial of a non-invasive telemonitoring system based on monitoring of signs, symptoms, and daily weight change. The TIM-HF trial, which was presented by Stefan Tu, and the 10-HMS trial, all randomized controlled trials, all of substantial size, ranging from about 400 to more than 1,600 patients, and all share in common the fact that they failed. Now, why did these trials fail? Well, there are a variety of possibilities. Perhaps poor patient compliance with monitoring explains some of the failure, and that may be the case in the TELE-HF trial, where monitoring or adherence to the monitoring system was relatively low. It could be that these patients were well treated at baseline and it was tough to produce incremental gains. That's been argued for the result of the TIM-HF trial. There may be limitations of the effector arm. Even if we know that patients are getting worse, we may not be able to do anything to make them better. But I would suggest that poor sensitivity of weight change and symptoms and the lack of actionable information, and I might also add the lack of specific guideline recommendations for what to do with this information, may have also contributed to the negative outcomes. Another example, now moving from non-invasive to invasive monitoring, is the DOT-HF trial. And this was one of the two trials that was highlighted in the program booklet for this session. The DOT-HF trial is the first and to date the largest randomized controlled trial of intrathoracic impedance monitoring in the monitoring and management of heart failure patients. This was a prospective randomized controlled intervention trial of intrathoracic impedance monitoring in which the treatment arm underwent management with both standard clinical assessment and also access to intrathoracic impedance data. And the control arm was managed using standard clinical assessment alone. The investigators were blocked access was blocked to the intrathoracic impedance data in the control patients. The endpoint was all-cause mortality and heart failure hospitalizations. You can see the entry criteria on the bottom of the slide. And really, the hypothesis here was that knowledge of intrathoracic impedance, and this included, this was a European trial, a patient alert. So when a threshold was crossed and the alert went off, in fact, maybe this would prompt more outpatient interaction with the patient, but that would allow the physician to take an action and prevent a hospitalization. Did it work? The answer is no. 335 patients followed for an average of 15 months. In fact, there was an increase in outpatient clinic visits, 240 outpatient visits in the treatment arm versus 84 in the control arm. That might not necessarily be a bad thing, although it's a threefold increase in the number of outpatient interactions, but that might not be a bad thing if the number of hospitalizations was reduced. Unfortunately, the risk of hospitalization was increased by nearly 1.8-fold in this study. Now, it's important to note that specific algorithms or guidelines for treatment were provided. Physicians didn't know what to do with this information. They brought the patients into their clinic more often, and because they saw them more often and didn't know what to do with the information, they hospitalized them more frequently. So this brings us now to the next level of invasiveness. We're using implantable hemodynamic monitors. And here we have likewise learned that hemodynamic monitoring, while perhaps our most precise measure of heart failure clinical status, doesn't work if we don't provide guidelines for its use. And we learned that in two randomized controlled trials, the COMPASS-HF trial and the REDUCE-HF trial, trials of 274 and 400 patients respectively. In these trials, it's important to note that no protocol recommendations for treatment were made, no hemodynamic targets were identified, and there were no significant reductions in heart failure-related events or heart failure hospitalizations. And let me just show you data from the COMPASS trial, because you can see a curve looking at average of daily median pressures over 6 months and their relationship to heart failure events. And what this shows you is that as the pressure falls below 25 millimeters of mercury, there is a sharp decline in the risk of having a heart failure event, hospitalization, emergency room visit, or unscheduled clinic visit. But look at what happened in the trial. Because no guidelines were provided and no therapeutic targets were mandated by the protocol, the average EPAD in the treatment group was 25 millimeters of mercury compared to 27 millimeters of mercury in the control group, a difference of only 2, and in fact, the treatment group didn't even approach that level of pressure reduction, which is associated with a steep decline in the risk of having heart failure events. So all of these lessons were learned during the course of these studies and applied to the design of the Champion Trowel, which is the second of the two studies highlighted in the program guide for this session. And the Champion Trowel approach was to combine hemodynamic monitoring with treatment guidelines, which also included specific targets, specific hemodynamic targets, and a support system with the hypothesis that all of this, this strategy for management, would significantly improve clinical outcomes. Now, did we in fact intend to test a strategy and not just an implantable device? The answer is yes, and I think it's quite clear in the design paper for the Champion Trowel. In fact, the term strategy is used no less than 7 times in this design paper. And I'll show you one example from the discussion in the design paper for the Champion Trowel, which stated that by providing standard approaches to hemodynamic information as part of the protocol, and by having specific filling pressure goals also outlined in the protocol, Champion will be the first detailed hemodynamic-guided heart failure treatment strategy tested in a prospective randomized clinical trial. So this was not simply implanting a device and just waiting to see what happened, but this was implanting the device and providing specific targets and specific algorithms to assist the clinicians in improving patient outcomes. This slide reviews the protocol-mandated hemodynamic targets, and you'll see, for example, here the pulmonary artery diastolic pressure target was 8 to 20. Our clear intent was to get patients into that range that Compass demonstrated was associated with a reduction of events. We said 25 wasn't good enough, and it didn't work in the Champion trial. We have to encourage clinicians to lower the pressure if we're going to test the hypothesis that reduced pressures improve outcomes. So these were protocol-mandated hemodynamic targets. In fact, not reaching these targets was considered a protocol deviation, unless the investigator could document an untoward clinical event, such as hypotension, worsening renal azotemia, or syncope or presyncope. And if they weren't, not achieving these pressure targets was considered a protocol deviation and required a coordinator to actually fill out a protocol deviation form. And then specific treatment algorithms and reference to national guidelines were provided in the protocol. Here they were provided in Appendix E of the protocol. I'm going to show you one example. And I need to credit my colleague and co-principal investigator, Phil Adamson, who really led the development of these treatment algorithms. But you can see here that stated in the protocol, if we can click forward one, not a whole slide, but just go forward. Click one for me, please. I can't get this to work. Should highlight what's shown in the second paragraph on this slide, taken verbatim from Appendix E, that the Champion trial will differ from previous hemodynamic monitoring studies in that specific recommendations will be made to utilize pressure in heart failure management, including the use of diuretics and vasodilators. And then goes on to say at the bottom that when we haven't been quite specific enough, because maybe we can't anticipate all options in the protocol, that the investigator should refer to the ACC AHA heart failure guidelines. So here's an example of the algorithm provided to investigators in the Champion trial. This is the algorithm for elevated pulmonary artery mean pressure included in Appendix E, which shows that if the pressure is elevated, then the first thing to do is to assume that this is associated with volume overload and increase the dose of or add a diuretic. And then the next step was, if the diuretic doesn't use, to consider that this might be related to a decrease in venous capacitance and to consider the addition of a vasodilator. And there was a lot of text around these algorithms trying to outline what patients, what investigators should do. And there were also algorithms around the euvolemic and the hypovolemic state included in the study. So what happened in the Champion trial? 550 patients were randomized. All patients received a device. And patients were kept blinded to their study assignment, so this was a single-blind study. And what differed was clinician access to the data. So in 270 patients called the treatment arm, management was based on access to hemodynamics plus traditional information. And in the control arm, access to hemodynamics was blocked to the investigators, and management was based on traditional information. Primary endpoint, recurrent heart failure hospitalizations over 6 months. All patients were maintained in their single-blind study assignment until the last patient achieved 6 months of follow-up, so that the average follow-up for all patients was about 15 months, ranging to about 30 months, so that we could also look at the durability of effects. So first of all, let me show you the effects of knowledge of pressure on medication changes. Did knowing pressures affect changes in medications? The answer is yes. If you start on the far right-hand side of this slide, you can see that in both the treatment arm shown in red and the control arm shown in brown or tan, that the rate of non-pressure-based medication changes was about the same. But these still occurred. So non-pressure-based, clinically-based decisions about medication changes were going on in both groups equally as background in these patients. And what really differed then were the number or the rate of pressure-based medication changes seen, of course, only in the treatment arm that had access to hemodynamic data. Now, the notion here was that these pressure-based medication changes would result in a reduction in pulmonary pressures. And remember, we really wanted to get them down into a target range associated with an improvement in outcome. And did that happen? The answer is yes. One of the prospectively powered secondary endpoints of the CHAMPION trial was pressure assessed by area under the curve, and this was significantly reduced in the treatment arm and not reduced in those patients randomized to the control arm. And then the next step of the hypothesis was that this pressure reduction would result in improved outcomes. And Stefan Anker already showed you this slide. Bottom line, primary endpoint was achieved with a very small p-value of 0.0002 at 6 months, 28% relative risk reduction in recurrent heart failure hospitalizations. And over the full duration of study, that relative risk reduction improved to 37% over an average follow-up of 15 months. So to put all of this together, using pulmonary artery pressure as our target for heart failure management, medication changes made on the basis of pulmonary artery pressures guided by protocol-specific algorithms resulted in a reduction in pulmonary artery pressures, and that in turn resulted in a significant reduction in heart failure hospitalizations. And while I didn't show you the data, this was also associated with a significant improvement in quality of life, which was also a powered secondary endpoint of the trial. So in considering the implications of CHAMPION for future monitoring studies, I would suggest that first we need to start with monitoring information that is actionable. Hemodynamics are directly actionable. I think it's debatable whether or not weight is a directly actionable parameter for a telemonitoring trial. Targets should be set and should be enforced by protocol rather than left up to the investigator, because we've seen in many prior studies when it's left to the investigator, it just isn't used. The information isn't used and the goals of the trial are not achieved. Specific treatment algorithms should guide response to diagnostic information, and compliance and education systems should be put into place to support implementation of these algorithms. Thank you for your attention.
Bill, why don't you stay there so we can take questions. Just a clarification, the COMPASS trial did have a strategy. It was a diuretic strategy, because I remember Bob Borge being very specific about he was going to put in so many milligrams of furosemide or whatever. It was a very basic strategy, but they were thinking in that direction.
Yeah, so you know, I think that was sort of Bob's, you know, strategy, and he implemented it, I'm sure, at his own site. But in the protocol itself, the only thing that was outlined were three states: hypervolemic, optivolemic, and hypovolemic. And optivolemic was essentially whatever the investigator wanted it to be. We had instances where patients had estimated pulmonary diastolic pressures as high as 35 or 40, where the clinician said they look okay, so that's Optive only mic for that patient. So there really was no encouragement in those patients to bring those pressures down.
Questions from the panel?
I would like to add something to the DOT-HF trial that you presented. I think it's important to emphasize that remote monitoring or telemonitoring was not used in that study, and that it was basically the patient alert that would alert what whether the situation was wrong. So it was up to the patient to go to the hospital, and what happened is basically the patient went to the hospital when the alert went off, but not necessarily to see his physician. What we see in the study is that more than half of the cases that the patient was hospitalized, the device was not interrogated. So even the device gives the alert, the patient goes to the hospital, and still the doctor doesn't look at the data because he's not aware of a protocol, he's not aware of what he should be doing. So I think therefore it's what you're proposing and what you did in the CHAMPION study is certainly the right thing to give more guidance to what the protocol should be.
I have a curiosity regarding to which additional information you need in addition to pulmonary artery pressure in order to apply an appropriate algorithm. For instance, would you couple this with arterial blood pressure and body weight, or would you use that only? And also, how many patients do you believe that have actually low cardiac output as the main manifestation of heart failure? For these patients, certainly pulmonary artery pressure would not be an appropriate way to behave. And actually, I'm aware that you could probably have, from the pressure waveform, a relatively good estimate of cardiac output. So do you believe this will be available in the future, and the coupling of the two values could considerably improve, potentially, the outcome of the algorithm?
Yeah, so let me answer the second question first. And first of all, I do think that we will be able to get cardiac output information out of these waveforms and out of these devices, and I think that may add, you know, something to our ability to manage these patients. That being said, from our total experience with the Chronicle system, with the CardioMEMS system, with the HeartPod system, what we've seen is that about 90%, maybe 90, close to 95% of these admissions are due to hemodynamic congestion. Only a small proportion of these admissions are due to sort of pure low output syndromes, patients dry or euvolemic, and has a low cardiac output. So we can have a major impact on reducing heart failure hospitalization simply by targeting congestion, although we may be able to refine that a little bit further and pick up that additional 5 to 10% of episodes that might be strictly related to a low cardiac output state. And I'm sorry, what was the first question?
No, it was related to the usefulness of adding, for instance, arterial pressure or body weight to the...
Yeah. So it's important then to note that, you know, what we tested and what we told investigators, because we really wanted to assess the hypothesis that pressure was the target of treatment, so we treated pressure. Now, you know, of course, this was treated with, you know, with knowledge of, you know, other things, you know, traditional, you know, standard of care knowledge about how the patient's doing. But what we told the investigators is, even if the patient feels well, even if they're asymptomatic, even if they have no signs or symptoms of congestion, if their pressure is elevated, you have to lower it. So the pressure really was predominant and overrode those other clinical parameters.
Because I would imagine it depends a little bit how you select the patient. For instance, if you have a patient with 80 millimeters of mercury of arterial blood pressure, would you still use a vasodilator if you can't put down the pulmonary artery pressure or not?
Yeah, no, I think probably not. I mean, you do have to take those things into consideration for making your treatment decisions. So you do have to look at the totality. And if you noticed at the bottom of the algorithm that I said, the very bottom, and this was included, but, you know, the ultimate treatment decision is still in the hands of the clinician. These are guidelines, but the clinician still can look at the totality of patient information in making a decision about what to do. Now, you do bring up another interesting issue that I wanted to touch on during our earlier discussion, which relates to the endpoints. Because, you know, we're presuming that the use of all of these monitoring devices should only prevent hospitalizations. But I think we really need to start to look at this a little bit differently, because there are preventable hospitalizations And there are likely non-preventable hospitalizations. And in some instances, we've seen patients with hemodynamic monitors that have refractory elevations of pressures. And what we've learned about those patients is that they are at extremely high risk for mortality. And those patients should probably appropriately be hospitalized, and if appropriate candidates for, move down a pathway to an LVAD or a transplant. So I would suggest that in that setting, you know, the hospitalization really isn't a bad thing. It's a good outcome of having knowledge of their hemodynamics. So this is just one other nuance to these studies that we have to figure out. You know, right now we take all heart failure hospitalizations and group them together, but not all heart failure hospitalizations are preventable. A patient who's hypotensive with congestion and worsening renal function, you're probably not, even with knowledge of the pressures, you're probably not going to keep that patient out of the hospital.
Just one final clarification. In your randomized group that had traditional info, what was that made up of?
So we didn't specify that every center do exactly the same thing. Each of the centers that participated in the CHAMPION trial had a heart failure disease management program of some sort. And we told them to continue their standard of care. Some of them may have used some telemedicine system. Some of them may have just used the typical, you know, phone calls or telling patients to self-monitor their symptoms and changes in daily weights. Some of them may follow serial biomarkers, for example. So it was whatever the standard of care was, you know, at each of those 35 centers.
Yeah, from the experience with the pacemakers with the impedance monitoring and also from the chronicle that heart rate monitoring, in a lot of instances, atrial fibrillation was what triggered the pressure increment. And with CardioMEMS, you don't have that. So do you know anything in the CHAMPION to which extent atrial fibrillation was what triggered pressure increments?
Yeah, so we didn't systematically collect rhythm information in that trial, but we learned from each study we do. We are collecting that prospectively in the laptop HF study to look at the influence of atrial and ventricular arrhythmias on decompensation, and also to look at the influence of pressure lowering on those events as well. Perhaps the risk of those events may be reduced through tighter control of pressure.
You can infer atrial fibrillation from the pressure tracing.
That's true.
And actually, in many cases, the physicians did pick up atrial fibrillation from the pressure tracing.
Of course, it's very important. I mean, about half of these patients probably have atrial fibrillation because of their heart failure state.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And you can infer that from the tracing. It's pretty easy to see when they're in AFib and rapid ventricular response.
And the sicker they are, the more likely they are to have AFib. Thank you, Bill.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions from the audience for Dr. Abraham? We're trying to stick to the time here, so it leaves us like 8 or 9 minutes for our last set of discussion. Thank you, Bill.